So before we start the summer edition of Dirt Church Radio, we just need to tell you quickly that we are supported by the most amazing companies and clubs: Wild Things, Ultra Spire, Scott Running, and Further Faster, the best independently owned sportswear, outdoors wear, sportswear doesn't even begin to cut it, in the known universe. And please go and support them this summer. If you need gear, if you need the best packs, the best shoes, the best sense of community, or indeed anything for outdoor use, these are the people that you need to see.
True.
It goes something like Further Faster there in Christchurch. Rocky is hairy and so is Badger. Jules is nice and Jacob is delicious. Go to Further Faster now.
Oh, Further Faster there in Christchurch. Rocky is hairy and so is Badger. Jules is nice and Jacob is delicious. Go to Further Faster now.
Dirtchurch Radio.
It's summer, everything's lovely. You're listening to Dirtchurch Radio. Episode 227.
We made it.
Welcome to the third of our Summer Greatest Hits special. How's your summer going so far?
Yeah, great, thanks. Nice and humid in Tāmaki Makaurau. But yeah, good, thanks, good. Plenty of people getting out there and smashing their training for the big races ahead and that have just been. It's a bit weird. I mean, look, behind the curtain, we're recording all these at the same time, so we're in a bit of a strange space, time-space continuum here, but if you're training for races coming up, keep going. Hope you're enjoying these summer specials. If you're training for a race that just happened,
we think you did really well, and we're both very proud of you. But look, this week...
We see you.
One of the things that stuck with me over the year of Dirt Church Radio is that idea that women aren't just small men, which sounds eminently sensible when you think about it, but does bear repeating. So we thought that we would bring you one of the biggest hits of the year, Dr. Stacey Sims, episode 196, Masters of Science, PhD, exercise physiologist and nutrition scientist, who... what she's doing is aiming to revolutionize exercise, nutrition, and performance, particularly for women. Directed research programs at Stanford, AUT, and the University of Waikato, focusing on female athlete health and performance. She's an ultra runner, a rower, Ironman, triathlete, author. She's been on Oprah.
Yeah.
She's been on Dirt Church Radio. She's got a TED Talk.
Yeah.
Been there, done that.
And people love this episode, so... we thought it was worth repeating. But first, we wanted to keep up the Greatest Run Ever slot because, you know, people love it. And so, have a listen to this.
Greatest Run Ever. Greatest Run Ever, which is the part of the show where we ask you to write into us and tell us your greatest run ever. Doesn't have to be a race or a mountain summit. It might just be a run around the block. Something that's sung to you for some reason. Send them in to us, dirtchurchradio@gmail.com. This is from Jasmine. I heard your call of needing some greatest runs ever. It's one of my favourite segments of the show, so here's one I wrote up a while ago but never sent in. And she's got in brackets, I know, I'm sorry.
We'll forgive you.
We forgive you this time. Back in February, I had a new one. When I sent in my first one, I was struggling with the same kind of thing, months in lockdown, feeling stuck and like there's no direction ahead. This time around, I was stuck in Auckland when we were in lockdown for months, staying home while all of our friends around the country were having adventures. Being a first responder, I was lucky to still be able to get out of the house and go to work, but that can still lead to lockdown fatigue, which from what I could tell was not just a problem for me, but for most Aucklanders. Now that Omicron has taken hold and we're no longer locked down and confined to one city, we can travel, and even though we still can't race, we can have adventures. I've been training for the Tarawera Miler, which was understandably cancelled. Once this happened, I finally admitted the inevitable. I needed a break. So I took one. I put my coaching on hold. I booked a whole lot of leave at work, little adventures here and there to keep me outside and keep me sane. This one wasn't even supposed to be a run. I was supposed to be walking the Abel Tasman with a friend, but she pulled out due to injury. I still wanted to go, so decided to make it a fast-packing mission. I'd never done fast-packing before, but I've always been intrigued by it. I love tramping and I love trail running, so why not mix them together? So I stuffed 3 days' worth of gear into a 20-litre backpack and jumped on a plane down to Nelson. The next day I was off. I took a water taxi to Appletree Bay and I started my run there. It was a nice, easy day, approximately 18 kilometres, and taking in the views of the coastline. I immediately fell in love with the Abel Tasman coastline, taking the views and taking breaks in the cool, clear waters, which are cold by Auckland standards, she puts it. They are. Yeah, I made it to the first hut at Bark Bay and spent the rest of the day on the beach watching the cheeky little wicker trying to steal bits of food or cups of water off other trampers. After a night's sleep, I got up early and was off again. I had 31 kilometres to cover. I got to Awaroa Hut before low tide, so I had a quick break and sat with the others while we watched some trying to cross early, basically ending up fully submerged in the inlet packs and all. I made the wise idea to wait and crossed while it was knee-deep. That sounds like a getting fully submerged with a pack on, isn't it? No, it's
salty water.
Yeah. Or just the 50-liter pack on your back. Yeah. The rest of the day was like a dream, out in a new area exploring and just doing what I love, stopping to take advantage of the waters and chatting to other trampers. I made it to the last hut in just over 5 hours with plenty of daylight to spare and made some friends for the night as trampers trickled in throughout the evening. We spent the night talking about other adventures we had done and what we'd planned coming up. Day 3 was a much easier 5 kilometres over the hill to where I was being picked up. I just ticked off my first great walk and my first ever fast pack. This may not be just one single run, but a few days of running. Afterwards, I was refreshed, inspired, and ready for the next adventure. And that's what makes this my greatest run ever.
Jasmine, you nailed it. Absolutely nailed it. And I was remembering the time I got on the Abel Tasman track and absolutely fell in love with it as well. Didn't get fully submerged in a thing. But that was last century. Wow. So it's time I got back. Thank you for reminding me. Thank you for sending it in. The rest of you, keep sending them in. dirtchurchradio@gmail.com. You know the drill. Right.
Stacey Sims, PhD, author, exercise physiologist, nutritionalist, advocate for the female athlete. Here we go. It's a fantastic conversation. Enjoy.
Dirt Church Radio.
Just like to welcome to Dirt Church Radio, Stacey Sims. Stacey, kia ora. Can we just say from the get-go that you are here by popular demand? We canvass people who come on the podcast and say, who would you like us to speak to? And your name has come up several times with some incredible athletes who wanted us to reach out. So thank you so much for coming on. And how are you doing?
Oh, well, that means that my disguise in New Zealand is no longer around.
No,
my
you
low
failed
profile.
There.
Oh no. No, I'm really excited to be talking to you guys. So yay, thanks for having me.
Look, we recently had Emma O'Reilly on the podcast, who I understand that you guys are collaborators, probably the wrong word, or academic. What is the word?
I am her mentor, one of her mentors.
Fantastic.
Or PhD supervisor, but I prefer mentor. It's better.
Yeah, okay. Sorry for my complete lack of academic knowledge there.
It's okay.
And she passed on some really important information to us and got us talking about periods and making use of a woman's menstrual cycle in terms of recovery. From your perspective, what are the things that female runners and particularly endurance runners should consider?
I think the biggest thing that endurance runners need to consider is eating enough. Because if you don't eat enough, and people look at me like, what? No, you know, and it's not just eating enough in the day. It's actually timing your food in and around your training. And the reason I say that is because if we are doing subsequent fasted training or we're not paying attention to when we are eating, then we have a disruption in our endocrine system, which leads to a downturn of a resting metabolic rate, lean mass loss, and menstrual cycle dysfunction. And if we get menstrual cycle dysfunction or we lose our periods, then we're leaving a lot of performance potential on the table, because it means that we're not healthy enough to sustain daily life stress and training stress. So we see this a lot in endurance athletes where they're like, I don't understand. Like I'm not getting any better. I'm not adapting to my training. I'm putting on a little belly fat and I'm always tired no matter how much sleep I get. And we just rejig what they're eating in and around their training with not necessarily increasing total intake. And then all of a sudden they're like, whoa, I get it. I feel better. And generally, we have to increase total intake too. But the first thing is really understanding that when you are running, training, racing, whatever, that's a massive stress. And just the same as you wouldn't take a car on the road on E, you wouldn't put yourself in a race or a good hard training situation without fuel, because you're not going to get adaptations. And regardless of what you're reading in popular media about, you know, having adaptations to be able to burn more fat, as a woman, you're already there. And we also know that those adaptations do not translate into better performance. Your body starts burning more fat because that's what's there. It's fat and lean mass, but that doesn't mean you're going to go faster. It just means that your body's under a lot of stress.
And people, I mean, people think of sort of nutrition and taking these things seriously from a kind of an elite athlete perspective. But if you're running a lot of miles or if you're doing any kind of training, it's something you need to consider, right?
Absolutely. One of my colleagues down in Otago, Catherine Black, she's done quite a bit of research into the recreational female athlete. And from that, we understand that over 50% of recreational women in New Zealand are in what we say low energy availability, or they have this misstep. So they might see it as not adapting to training. They might see it as not being able to gain lean mass, but a lot of it is menstrual cycle irregularity. And unfortunately, there's a high precedence of people using an oral contraceptive pill or an IUD because they're kind of in that sporting space, not only for contraception use, but also for manipulating periods or not having one. And they mask the ability to understand if you're adapting or not. So there's a whole bunch of things to unpack for female athletes to understand, but the cornerstone of it all is being able to fuel for what you are doing so that your body can understand that stress, overcome it, and adapt to it so that you can put more stress on the body and be resilient to that stress.
So what are the ways in which what are the differences in terms of nutrition for men and women? What are the things that women should consider when they are embarking on some training?
That's exactly what I was writing about today, because I'm finishing up a position stand for a nutrition society. So first and foremost is when I'm talking about the fueling state, the thresholds for women getting into trouble with their health and the threshold for men getting into trouble with their health are completely different. So what I mean by that is we know that a sedentary, regular kind of normal weight woman needs around 45 calories per kilogram of fat-free mass just to exist per day.
And so when that's you start, that's just to keep the organs.
That's just for respiration.
Yep. And right. When that drops down to below 30, or really the cut point is 30, we start to see a downturn of metabolic rate, thyroid dysfunction, menstrual cycle dysfunction. So that's 30 calories per kilogram fat-free mass. For men, it's 15. So at the threshold of 15, we start to see a drop in testosterone and some of the responses that we see with low energy availability. And it has to do with the brain and the sensitivity of the hypothalamus to calorie intake and nutrition density. And women have two areas in the brain that are sensitive because we have a menstrual cycle and we're meant to reproduce, and men only have one area. So when we're talking about fueling and the nuts and bolts of fueling, men can get away with so much more, like fasted training, low-carb, high-fat, ketogenic diet, because their sensitivity to nutrition density is so much different than women's. So when we start saying, how do women fuel? The cornerstone of everything, regardless if we're looking at hormonal status, is that they're eating enough, especially in and around training, even if you're trying to lose weight, because when you're eating in and around training, you are able to give your body the fuel it needs to understand the stress you're putting it on, running stress, understanding that it can adapt and overcome that, and that's how we get fitter. And then if you're looking to manipulate body composition or to lose weight, you have a slight calorie deficit away from training. But if you delay eating after training, you stay in a breakdown state, which then signals the body, I don't have enough food. So then you get into the same thing as if you were to have done fasted training. But for men, doesn't matter. We know that men's baseline glucose levels come down around 21 hours after a training session. But for women, it's 2. So wow. We come back down to that baseline so much faster. There's lots of different metabolic changes that happen, which I won't go into all the details, even though it's right in front of me on my other screen. But for the nuts and bolts of it, when we look at like recommendations for training, carbohydrate intake recommendations, everything's based on male data. So what we're finding is there's not a huge amount of data out there for women to base it on. So we start with the cornerstone of carbohydrate availability. So that means eating enough. We know that when women have a higher amount of carbohydrate in their diet, and they're taking in some carbohydrate while they're running, they actually increase the amount of carbohydrate their body can burn, and they end up sparing more carbohydrate in their liver and their muscle. So afterwards, they're able to burn more body fat at rest, as long as they fuel properly. But if they don't, then they're stripping down body fat, they're burning lean mass, amino acids, and their body stays in this breakdown state, conserving, conserving, conserving. For men, it doesn't happen that way.
And that's a real head shift, isn't it? Because it just seems so counterintuitive. Like, oh, I better not, you know.
I know.
As runners, we're so kind of, lots of people are obsessed with it. And overeating is, you know, oh, I don't want to eat too much and da-da-da. But what you're saying is, hey, you're going to get into trouble if you don't fuel properly.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the case studies that we often bring up, Catherine has looked at this a lot as well, is, you know, a lot of the FITSPO stuff out there, and people are like, oh, my baseline calorie intake is 1,500 calories. And on my rest day, I'm only going to have 1,500 calories. But when we look realistically at a woman who is, you know, mid-20s, early 30s, maybe 60 kilos, 20 to 22% body fat, that 1,500 calories is just enough for her to lie on the couch and watch Netflix all day, right? And as soon as you get up and you have your working life, you're looking at adding another 600 to 800 calories. Then you add running into that, you're looking at another 400 to 800 or more calories. So a recreational female runner who's running four times a week, and it could be anywhere from 30 to 90 minutes, is on the upwards of 25 to 3,500 calories a day, depending on what her training is. And that is a significant amount of food that people aren't taking in. So when we start to explain it and say, hey, let's put a little bit in and around training to give your body that boost, but also increase calorie content, their bodies just respond amazingly. Like, everyone's so afraid, I'm going to overeat, this calorie in, calorie out thing. But it's not about that. It's about, let's see what the stress is, let's fuel, and our appetites are dynamic, our macronutrient needs are dynamic depending on what we're doing in the day. And so we're not algorithms. We can't be like, okay, I need 1,500 calories today, I need 1,600 tomorrow, and then I'm going to do a long run on the weekend, so I'm going to end up with 2,000 calories. It does not work that way.
It's so striking, and it sort of, where do you think these narratives have come from? They're so unhelpful, you know, around, and not, I mean, specifically around sort of the unhelpful narratives around menstrual cycles, or this unhelpful narrative around this very linear process of calorie in, calorie out. I for a time, worked in an emergency department, and there was a group of nurses who decided to do this FITSPO challenge. You know, these are young men and women, predominantly women, working 12-hour emergency department shifts, and they were restricting themselves to 1,500 calories a day. Do you know? And they were doing 12-hour hammer and tongs ED work. You know, you're doing 20,000 steps at work. You know, you're doing, and just a boatload of miserable, grumpy ED nurses who all fell off the back of it really quick, because it was like hell on earth.
Yeah.
Where do these narrative? What I mean, what drive in your research or your experience? What drives this narrative?
So there's a lot of social and cultural context that comes behind it. And if we look, like, obviously, I'm not New Zealand born because of my accent. So coming from this,
a very very passable Mount Maunganui accent, Doctor.
Yeah. but growing up in the US and understanding that culture and understanding where a lot of these narratives came from. Like in the early 1920s, when there were women who were allowed to be in the Marines, an Admiral General said, I want my female Marines to be the trimmest, the prettiest, and most well put together of all of the services. And do you know how that translates now? They're held up against standards that are just not applicable through BMI. They don't look at body composition, they look at BMI, and they look at how they look in a very small uniform. And when we look at how the bodies have changed with the implementation of lifting and CrossFit and being able to move and lift as much as your male counterpart, the women are in so much distress and getting sick and dropping out of their career because of this one statement that was held to them back in the 1920s. And when we look through history, we see this. There's like one of the lectures I give, I talk about how feminism comes to women out of the workplace and being able to express themselves. And JFK had a statement and he said, "I'm all for women participating and being out of the house, contributing to society, as long as it doesn't pull from their primary responsibility, which is at the home." So you'd have these things where women are encouraged to get out and do stuff, but then backlashed about what their duties are, what they're supposed to look like. And we see this throughout sport and sport history. Like if we look at what does it mean to be in sport? What does it mean to be an athlete? We see images of male aggression, power, speed, all of those really male-oriented images. And so when that gets reflected onto women, they don't want to express the fact that they are female because it's a fallibility in the sporting environment. And this narrative has been through history, and we're starting to see the pushback now with more and more female athletes saying, "Hey, wait, I don't want red S. I don't want to not be able to have a job because I'm pregnant and I'm a professional athlete." So we're seeing a lot of that pushback now, but we have a long way to come. I mean, even things like going to the gym right now. You walk into a gym and what do you see? You see most women in the spin classes, the HIIT classes, on the cardio machines. And where do you see the guys? You see the guys directed to the weight room, the squat racks. It's a very masculine orientation. And when you walk in as a first-time gym person, the questions that they ask, what are your goals? They always ask the women, is weight loss one of your goals? They ask the men, how strong do you want to be? So it's the language that is perpetuating these narratives. And when you're a young woman growing up in sport, and that's your first encounter of, I want to get fit, and you go to a gym and you see this, and then you might join a woman's running group, and the narrative is still there because it's a bunch of women who come from the same background. There isn't a way to stop it unless we start really kind of digging into that narrative and pushing out and saying, look, it's not about calories in, calories out. It's not about how thin you are. It's about your health and performance. So, sorry, that was my rant.
No, no, I think one of my favorite stories to tell is my first ever proper sports watch. Like it was a proper GPS one. I got it on a closeout website, right? This thing was like cocaine white. It was rad. It was so 80s. Yes. Big, you know, my first one, I was like stoked. And I went onto the website of the company to check it out, you know, and it was the same model as the black one and the red one and the army camouflage one or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like there was a white one and there was a rose gold one. And those two were the women's model. And it was exactly the same watch. But the advertising, like it was like on the, you could connect to text and it was like, do you want to go like get swole or rip it up or do whatever? And the narrative on the woman's watch, the white, the cocaine white one, which is awesome, yeah, was, hey, you know, coffee group, or it's just, and I wrote, I actually everywhere wrote the company, and not that, I mean, I never got a reply, but I was like, you bastards, like, what are you, and not to virtue signal either, it was just so, like, how can you even, just because you say something's this, it's the same watch, like, it's the same, it's the same thing.
Yep.
And I, yeah.
Marketing. Sorry, narrative. Rant over. No, yeah. I understand it. Yeah. And I see it all the time. And it's, I've become more and more aware of it as I've worked with Holly Thorpe, who we know is one of the renowned sociologists in New Zealand, if not the world. And so we both kind of have these crossover views and we understand each other's points. And so now whenever I find myself going to a conference or giving a talk, I'm always giving her perspective and people are all of a sudden going, oh my gosh, I didn't even realize it. So I think the more that we have those conversations of breaking down those barriers and saying, do you know where this comes from? I joke with people about netball. Now I might really, you know, blow up when I say this next statement. So forgive me, New Zealand listeners, but, as an American, I find netball a very misogynistic, old-fashioned, traditional sport, and there's only three countries that play it. And as an outsider, when I see that women have to wear skirts and they can't run and they're held to this ideal within these confines, I'm like, this isn't a sport. This is exactly the image of what that patriarchal idea thought that women should be playing sport. Same with beach volleyball in their talks, right? Instead of, so there's all these things that come up in sport, but no one questions it because it is how it has been.
And that's so true, isn't it? And that you know, you think of those young girls in the South Island having to play in the cold and they're not allowed to wear, you know, thermals or, you know, they're not allowed to wear, you know, long pants in the winter. And that sort of crazy behaviour in sports. And, yeah, the beach volleyball was classic, wasn't it? It's just, but that sort of conditioning and that sort of the narrative, really. And, you know, I just can't, the thing I can't figure out is, you know, we've had people like you, you mentioned Holly Thorpe, you know, Emma doing the work that she's doing. There's so many people out there pushing it and doing the work. And yet, you know, there still seems to be this problem and this resistance. What do you think it's going to take for sports and society to finally get the message and for there to be a step change?
I don't know. I mean, I look at New Zealand, right? A suicide didn't even make changes. It caused an investigation, but it didn't create change. Right? And I'm one of the people that sits on inside and outside, and I see it very closely. So the only hope that I have for the change is that we're seeing a lot of grassroots movement. We're seeing a lot of young girls in participation who are growing up to be leaders in that participatory aspect and looking for fun. And then we see a lot of the role models who are elite athletes now who are talking about their mental health. They're talking about the experiences that they've been having within the sporting environment. They're talking about wanting to be moms, or they're showing up with their babies at courtside or wherever they are in their sporting environment. And slowly, slowly breaking down those patriarchal aggressive views of what sport should be. Really, really happy to see that now USA Soccer has the equality of payment, right? So we have men and women. I think professional surfing was the first one to do it back in 2019. So slow change, but there is hope because there are people who are starting to roll it forward. And it's like, if tennis would come on board, then a whole bunch of things would happen.
Look, I mean, they've got several oases of strength, I'm sure, but, you know, finger on the pulse isn't one of them with tennis, is it? And I'd want to say that, you know, the U.S. women football, the U.S. women football team, because it's football, it's not soccer, slaps, like, so good.
I know.
Just the dude, they're so much better than the dudes. It's just incredible.
Yes, they are.
What is, sorry, I just realized, you know, talking about, not realized, because obviously I've thought of it before, but the whole five sets, I'm not even very good on tennis lingo, versus three sets. What is the message that's sent? And cross-country running as well.
Oh, cross-country running.
We are always going off about this, but the women's distance is less than the men's. What's it, and the boys and the girls?
Except for the old boys. We get to run. Oh, yeah. I get to get lapped by the same distance by both the junior men and the junior women, and most of the masters men and masters women. But
what is that about? Why do we put up with that?
Tradition. And it's that undercurrent idea that women are delicate. We see that in professional cycling. Like, I come from a professional cycling background, and the women were relegated to their distances could not be over 120K in one race. But you see men are 200, 210, right? And it's like, well, wait a second. You give us the opportunity. We train up for that. We would, and people are like, oh, well, it's not that exciting. It's not on TV. It's like, well, that's because we're not being put on TV. And if you were, it's the same with every sport, like the women participation and how hard they work and the limitations they have on it needs more exposure. But men's sport, of course, gets all the exposure, which limits women. But I mean, I look at like the women's sevens here in New Zealand, they're fantastic and fabulous players. And they were some of the first that got hit hard with lack of money during COVID. Yeah. And they are our Olympic medalists, right?
Yeah. Olympic champions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right?
And great role models and fantastic personalities and characters.
So
and
much.
It's just
like,
What can't they see here? It's just,
I know. And it's not media training. Those women are true to the soul. That's not media training. Yeah. So, yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like, I know you think about this, sort of working in a healthcare context, and there's some, you know, I've been a nurse for 21 years.
Don't say it. 10 years. What?
21.
21,
proud. I'm proud. Started when I was 17.
Okay, and, you know, that works.
I didn't have altruistic motives. I was like, this is excellent. Like, this is 17-year-old boy, it was a boy brain, you know, it's wicked. This is good odds. There's not going to be very many men. There's tons of girls, you know.
Yeah.
Realizing that you get folded in within about 2 days as being part of the cohort, you know, it didn't work out. I don't know why the maths didn't work out. But working in mental health, especially, there are some of those masculine kind of, like, you need big men and you need this and that, because there's an aura of kind of threat and physical performance. It's this horrible kind of ass backwards kind of narrative, and I found that, you know, like, being involved with, if there's a tense situation and you need to either de-escalate or contain a situation, I found that, and I say it very openly at work, you know, like, I've done it for a long time, like, I'll go with a team of women any day of the week, you know, because generally better at the de-escalation. And this is borne out by hundreds and probably thousands of these situations over that long, but
yeah,
generally better at the de-escalation and generally fitter and a bit kind of, you know, leaner and more sort of, you know, fashion, all that stuff that helps in those situations. Yet it's not, you know, oh, we need the 6'4" dude who's 200 kilos, you know, and he can get down onto the floor, but can he get back up? Probably not, really.
Probably not.
Probably not, yeah. But it's an interest, and it's that, yeah. How do we become allies, and what are some practical things that we as a society, and men in particular, can do? And how do you think we can do it with it being meaningful rather than being, because there seems to be, like, there's a kickback. Like, I'm sure there'll be people listening to this going, oh, they're virtue signaling, or, oh, they're doing that, or, you know, bunch of insert whatever kind of, you know, epithet there. What can we do to be sort of true allies to kind of smash this kind of narrative?
I come from an education background, so it's like the more we're educated about it and the more we talk about it, especially at the younger set, I think it's going to take generations to really push it over. Like, I'm very proud of my daughter, but she's my daughter, so she's open about talking about these things and pointing things out. But around her friends, she's still a little bit hesitant because it's still not that open. So when they're together in our house and we talk about things and I can hear their little conversations, I'm like, yeah, all right, you know, let's do this, let's go play football and beat the boys, and, you know, then after we beat them we'll say, yeah, come play with us, kind of thing, right? But then they get out and they don't do it. So there has to be that follow through from being confident within that small circle to being confident to a bit bigger circle. So it comes from both ends. We have to have management and coaches and stuff open and supportive and talking and seeing what's wrong with the environment, their own environment, not the tradition, not how things are done and always have been done, but within our own environment, how can we make it a little bit better, a little bit easier? Like, Alan Bunting did an amazing job with the Sevens and their culture, their way of doing things. I think if every sporting body could see how they operate, they would be like, this is how it should be done. It's not without fallibilities, of course, but it is a really good way of just going in and understanding what's going on and how can we make it our own, and then how can we expand that and be welcoming. And I think it's that step progression, and it starts young and it also starts at the top, and somehow we can meet in the middle.
That's kind of the education, also the communication, and, you know, exactly, as well as the science, you're so heavily involved in the communication. You know, your book Raw, you've got a new book out, TED Talks, talking on podcasts, getting the message out, trying to make things easily understandable and making people bring you on board. It's critical, isn't it, that communication aspect?
Yes, but it's still not without pushback. Like, right, get negative comments and you're challenging people's dogma all the time, and you get that negativity. And it's like, okay, well, I understand your point of view, but let's turn around. So it's I'm better now that I've been in it for a while and I can understand, like, I'm going to get pushback, but how do I see what their point of view is? Is there a way I can translate and make them understand a different viewpoint, get away from that male lens? A lot of times, no, because they're already set in how they believe. And it's both men and women. Mm-hmm. It's not just men, and it's hard. It's really soul-searing when a woman will backlash on an idea that's very masculine and very much from the patriarchal viewpoint. And no matter what kinds of things you say or examples, it doesn't change. So there's still a lot of that communication and understanding, and it's hard to push through. So then I'm like, okay, I'll put you in a little pocket and I'm just going to keep going this way. Because the bigger, what is it, the 1,000 true fans, right? So if we get, you have 1,000 true fans, Eugene, you have 1,000 true fans, Matt, Suzanne, you have 1,000 true fans. Like, so the more that we have and all of the fans keep saying the same thing, and the more we can break it down.
I remember when we talked to Catherine Switzer, which was epic. And
so lucky.
Two things I was struck by. One was my looking. There's that famous photo of her getting assaulted by that race director, you know, and her boyfriend at the time was a football player and he just kind of checked the dude out of the way. And I always remember looking at that photo and saying, that's an incredible photo. But then picking up on the fact that she says, you know, she, a genuine moment of fear, she was being assaulted at the time, you know, and so that kicked back. But then she went on and she explained that she didn't get so much pushback from the men. They were like, sort of, right on, this is cool, or, you know, like, there's a dog walking around with two heads or something, you know, like the uterus, whatever, but they were stoked with it. She said she'd get, when she was out training though, she'd get the wives and women pulling their cars, swerving their cars at her, yelling abuse at her, you know, getting out and sort of hissing at her and all that sort of stuff. I think that was a real kind of shocking, or not, I guess not shocking, but she was really strong on that. That was, you know, she felt much more kind of rage or distress and anger directed at her by the women around her than the men.
Yeah, challenging their dogma, right? She didn't fit in the box taking care of the home and doing all the things that the women were supposed to do, because she was, again, expressing a bit of the masculinity that is so much associated with their husbands and not with their own beliefs. She's one of my favorite people. I haven't met her in person, but her whole life and her story and everything she's done is just so amazing. And I often talk about her.
this is the breakout podcast, the KV Switzer Appreciation Society that you've joined. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks.
But you know, that's the thing that, you know, about her was, what she just it wasn't just about that one moment. She could have just taken that one moment, maybe, you know, kind of just run a few races, more runs, and then disappeared. But she didn't. She took it as something to use and to fight and to get women into the Olympic marathon. And to, I mean, she's absolutely incredible, isn't she? You know, the Avon Marathon series and so
all the things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely amazing. Anyway, look, you've got a new book out, Next Level. Tell us about that.
Can I hold it up since there's only 3 copies in the whole country?
Go on. Look at that. We'll do a screen grab.
Yeah, is that you being all jacked? And
no, it's not me. I could try. There.
Oh, wow. Jackson.
There we go.
That's jacked. Yeah.
Jacked.
Thanks. That's part of the whole next level thing. You got to lift heavy shit.
Yeah.
So this book has been a bit delayed in its whole publication because of COVID. But after Roar came out and started getting traction, there was a whole subset of women who were in their early 40s and beyond going, well, how does this apply to me? You have one chapter in this book, and there's a lot of things in here that doesn't make sense. And I took that to heart because coming from California, and I was working at Stanford, I was working with Marcia Stefanik, who was the principal investigator of the Women's Health Initiative. And so I was very much in the whole menopausal space and all of the changes that are happening. And I was doing half human performance, half women's health. And so it was always part of my thought process. And so when women were coming and saying, well, what do I do? And I was like, why don't you know? It just didn't dawn on me that that information wasn't out there. And then when my co-author Celine hit me up and was like, I don't understand what's going on. Like, we're supposed to write this book. I don't really feel like I can. But then a year later, she wrote me. She said, what the hell is going on? What do I do for this? So I told her some things to do, and she started doing it. And then she's like, oh my gosh, I just won Iron Cross, which is this massive cross race that she, So she won it in her age group. And she's like, I am fitter and stronger now than I was 3 years ago. And it's because I now understand what's going on. So then she's like, we can write this book. So the book is all about that whole perimenopause all the way through postmenopause and how our bodies change when the hormones flatline, because our female sex hormones that are responsible for menstrual cycle, they start to ebb and then don't come back. And that's the whole thing. With perimenopause, I think in New Zealand, they talk about it being the rushing woman syndrome, where the women are in their 40s and they're anxious, they can't sleep, they're highly stressed. They, quote, have adrenal fatigue, and there's no such thing as. And it's all being put down to this time in their life with regards to you have young kids, you might have older parents, you're at the peak of your career. But in actuality, if we take a step back, it's a physiological thing where we have estrogen and progesterone that are changing and it's affecting every system of our body. And then when we take it into like a running context, we see women who are hitting PRs and nailing it in their late 30s, early 40s, and they start to plateau and fall off. And people are like, what is going on? Why is my training not working for me? And unfortunately, the automatic response often is, I need to train harder and eat less, which is the opposite of what people should be doing. Because when we start looking at what's happening with these hormones dropping off, we have to find some kind of external stress to take the place of what these hormones used to do. So when we get into this phase and we start seeing body composition change, we know that we need to do lots of resistance training, high intensity work, some plyometric work. And unfortunately, all you long distance runners, dropping the volume, not doing long, slow distance, because women's bodies are already super adept at doing long, slow, but we lose the strength, we lose the power, we lose the speed. And that's what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this whole book covers. So excited about it.
Yeah.
When's it actually out?
Yeah.
Where can it came we get out one? Last week. You can order it now. Whitcools, Paper Plus. I went to Whitcools tonight with my daughter and I was looking on the shelf and they didn't have any, but they had a little thing in their computer. It's like on back order. And I was like, how many copies? They're like, we have 150 on back order. I'm like, yes. So that's good. Yeah. So it is available. I didn't have one until 2 days ago and our publisher sent one directly to me going, you need at least one book. So yeah.
How did it change your life?
So interesting about Roar is I never intended to write a book. I never really thought about it. And it came out right when we moved back to New Zealand from California. And there wasn't a lot of traction because I was in the States, couldn't promote it. It wasn't on social media. So it kind of was just a book until about 3 years ago. And then it took off. Could be part of social media, but also other people getting a hold of it. And that came to be because Celine came up to me after I gave a presentation at an endurance conference. And she's like, we need to write a book because this is the first time I've ever heard any woman say, period, menstrual cycle. Women are not small men. And I looked around the room in this endurance conference and I was like, yeah, because there's only like six of us women here. And a lot of people need to understand this. And so she pitched it to the publishers and she's like, yeah, we have this book contract. Let's do it. So it was all the things that I had been lecturing for years and talking about. And we put it into one book. And gosh, I hate to say we started that book about 10 years ago. So now it's time to update it.
And then so Next Level literally takes it to the next level and is speaking to women in another way, in another age, in another...
Yeah. Way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And are those things, the things that you set out there about not, you know, maybe dropping your training and having, you know, not eating less because you think that's what's going to make you better. Do you find that those things are still really misunderstood, that people don't get that?
Absolutely. 100%. Even a lot of physicians that have been on courses with me or talked to me, they didn't even understand that menopause is one point in time. It's one day on the calendar that marks 12 months since your last period. And that postmenopause is not where all the body composition changes happen. It's the 5 to 6 years beforehand. And when we look at the recommendations that are out there, they say 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity. And that is absolutely not what someone should be doing in this age group who's going through these hormones shifts, because in that moderate intensity zone, it's too easy to be hard, and we need it to be hard for those adaptations we're looking for. And it's too hard to be easy to drop cortisol and allow us to get into a parasympathetic state. And a lot of women use training as a stress release in their social construct and making friends or being by themselves, but it's somehow some of their own time, right? And if they keep doing that moderate intensity, or the tempo training, that kind of stuff, and they stay in that kind of gray zone, their baseline cortisol comes up. They have poor sleep because they just can't get out of that flight or fight sympathetic drive. Mm-hmm. And when we look at what does high intensity or true high intensity work, so we're looking at like Tabata work, or we're looking at 1 to 90 second high intensity work, like true high intensity. Yes, there's a spike in cortisol, but after you're done with that training, you have a massive spike of growth hormone and anti-inflammatory responses that then subsequently drop cortisol, which then allows you to get out of that sympathetic drive. And so there's the follow through that's not understood. There's a lot of people who talk about don't do high intensity work when you're in these menopausal years because it increases cortisol. But the follow through on that is, yes, but it drops because you have growth hormone, you have anti-inflammatory and antioxidation responses, which then subsequently help adaptation, sleep, mood, neurocognition, all of these things that we need.
So it's the it's almost the periodization, pardon the pun, of that work. I think about my wife. She worked at a prison for a couple of years, oh. And all of a sudden she was doing prison workouts at lunchtime with the corrections officers and the recreation staff, you know, and she'd bring it home and say, hey, Matt, do you want to try this with, you know, it was like Tabata work and stuff. And
yeah,
regularly would wipe the floor with me, you know, just the intensity of the workout. And it was gnarly. And I guess it's that thing, isn't it, that you can get done in, what is it, Tabata 8 minutes or something like that? Is that the,
yep.
And,
yep.
And you feel like you've been beaten to death with a baseball bat.
Exactly.
But then you've got the rest of the, yeah. You know, 23 and hours, 52 seconds of the day to recover.
Yeah, and people who are in endurance space, it's a huge mind shift. Mm. I have a lot of ultra runners who are like, what do you mean I don't have to do a 4 to 8 hour run on the weekend? It's like, well, actually, no. We do quality work in the week for 2 weeks. And then we have a deload week where we're not doing high intensity work. You have one long time on the feet where your rating of perceived exertion doesn't go over 5. If it means you have to slowly walk up the hill, you're doing it, because the goal of that is just getting used to time on the feet. It's the resistance training, the high intensity work that is going to feed forward and allow you to complete your race in a much better state at a better pace than if you were to go slog yourself for hours and hours and hours, not recover, not sleep, and stay in a parasympathetic state.
Mm. So that's, I mean, that is a real mind shift. And I guess you must have people coming to you who maybe are also being coached, and you're talking to them about these sorts of things. I imagine there's a lot of kind of coaches who don't get this. And
yep.
And also just that conditioning that we have. It's like, no, as a runner, I need to be doing X number of kilometers a week. I need to be doing my midweek long runs and long runs weekend after weekend. So do you have to have hard conversations?
I do have to have hard conversations. And a lot of the younger coaches get it because they want to know how to improve their athletes, because there's a higher percentage of women who are now participating and being competitive. And so if they're looking for longevity as a coach with their athlete relationship or having clientele that keeps coming back, then they need to learn. And that's part of it. But then I've also been told that there are different running groups and fitness forums that really don't like me. And it could be because I'm challenging their dogma, and that's all right. But I often go, let's just try it, see what works. And it's the generalization, but within every generalization, you also have to look at the person and individualize it to the person.
Is there a correlation between sort of the, you know, you're talking about cortisol levels and the parasympathetic response, that fight or flight. You know, we know research bears out that, you know, people surviving complex trauma or people surviving inter-domestic violence, you know, intimate partner violence, domestic violence, all that sort of stuff, is there any research or has there been any work done around that sort of stuff? If you're working with a person who's already sort of here and then expect, you know, they say exercise is therapy or running's cheaper than therapy or whatever all those kind of myths are. Has there been any work done around that sort of stuff?
There has been, and it's looking more from the neurocognitive and the ability to then tap into parasympathetic to get them out of that flight or fight, right? And again, we know that things like heavy resistance training, interval training, they do a lot of benefit to the brain and neurocognition. So it improves the volume of the brain, it improves blood flow to the brain, but it also improves nerve growth factor. So when people are under the sympathetic drive and they're in this heightened cortisol state, it does affect brain tissue and it does affect brain health. And so the first and foremost thing that we do is we look at what is exercise doing to give us that release and how does that work? So we look at the mechanistic aspects within neurophysiology. We start to see some of the connection between the growth hormone and the anti-inflammatory responses and the increased amount of creatine that comes and feeds the brain. And this really feeds forward to reducing that sympathetic state and that almost PTSD that people get from being in those situations.
Yeah, I mean, it must blow you away as to how far we've come, but still how much there is we don't know and we're still figuring out. Yeah. When I say we, I mean you, because, you know.
No, all of us.
Yes. I'm a knuckle dragger. That's right. You figure it out, Stacey.
And I'll report back.
That's right. Which is easy for me to understand, please.
Okay, perfect.
I loved raw. So, look, you tell us a bit about your background and particularly around getting into exercise physiology. Why did you go down that path?
When I was 13, I was a ballerina, but also running for fitness and because some of my friends did. And my instructor was like, you need to choose between ballet and running, and I recommend running. I was like, oh, okay. So I was running and I was living in San Francisco, and in San Francisco, we have the whole like, what now people say farm to table, but then it was just, here's all the growing areas, let's eat as close. So I was really interested in food and I wanted to be a chef and I was an athlete and I wanted to know how to fuel myself. And my parents were like, no chef life for my daughter, sorry. So I was like, oh, okay. So I ended up at a Big Ten school in the middle of Indiana. Never really took to Indiana. I found a big fight because I was a vegetarian in a very meat-oriented place, and I had joined the crew team, and I was like, okay, I'm going to fight this, and I'm going to be a political science major because then I'm going to understand the system. And I fell asleep in every single poli-sci class, but I stayed awake for the one exercise physiology class. And I was like, okay, so I know where I want to go. And as I got into it, being more, as an athlete and fighting for food, the more I understood how important the connection between nutrition and exercise was, but also wasn't getting answers. Like a textbook, it tells you the basic stuff. And then when you ask the professor or you're really digging in questions and they can't answer. And my mom will always tell anyone that I was always a kid asking why to the annoyance. And my daughter does that now. So it's kind of feedback or payback or whatever it is.
Yeah. It's karma.
But it's karma. Karma. And when I couldn't get answers, it didn't make sense to me. So that's kind of what pushed me through my academic career is trying to get the answers. But the whole time, I mean, I started as a cross-country runner. I got into crew. I got into ultra running and then got into bike racing and Xterra and raced high level across the board. And all of those, I'd always have these questions of how do I fuel? How do I hydrate? As a woman, why am I not responding the same? And then having the ability to go to the lab or be able to dig in and find those questions, find the answers or ask the questions and then do the research for the answers. So pretty much it's all been because I've been really interested in helping myself and being selfish. But now it's not so much that way. Now it's, yeah. everyone.
So it's, so it was kind of that more, I'm not going to call it selfishness, but that, that self-interest, and I don't mean that in that way either, but interest in yourself rather than some sort of aha moment that sent you down that path of being interested in women in particular.
No. I guess people would say the aha moment was, I think I've even said in my TED Talk, where on the crew team, we're all gearing up for Head of the Charles. And we were all training the same, meaning the lightweight women, the lightweight men. And the lightweight men would always seem to peak at the right time for the races, but the women were always tired and flat and felt overtrained and didn't understand what was going on. And so I started asking those questions and saying, well, why is it that we have really hard training days and all the women are beat up and the men aren't? And they're like, oh, it's because the men are fitter. It's like, no. When we look at the metrics and the ergs and we look at how much we can lift, we're pretty much the same, but no one could answer those questions. Mm-hmm. And then when I dig and dig, it's like, well, we actually don't study women. And it's like, well, why don't you study women? Well, we're too difficult. And I think that is where I was like, yeah, no one tell me that we're too difficult. Don't tell me you don't have the answers, because that's just not fair. And I'm always about fair. I'm like, I want everything to be fair. So if you're going to put a dude on the treadmill, then I want a woman on the treadmill. I'll be that woman. I want it to be fair. And so I think undergrad was really telling, because I couldn't get answers and I was so used to being able to find answers. And when I realized that there actually were none, because nothing had been done to find the answers, that's what I think was my drive. And still is my drive.
Mm. What would you tell the young ultra runner you to do differently?
Eat.
Simple as that.
Eat and recover. If you wake up tired and you feel like, oh my gosh, I don't want to put my shoes on because I'm too tired, sleep. Those are the two, just, you know, in the back in the day, because of course I'm not a spring chicken. Under recovery wasn't really talked about. It was do the miles, do them hard. If you're tired, just suffer through it. Like the rain, everything, it's good. It makes you hard. Do it. But yeah, I think I would go back and tell my younger self, nope, don't sleep, eat, recover, because that way you will, you know, adapt and get better. Yeah. And when you end up pacing people for things like Western State 100, you don't want to be the weak link, because they're the ones that are meeting you after 40 miles on the trail and you're the one who's supposed to be bringing the energy. So I think I would have had more energy if I had listened to me now back then, if that makes sense.
In the time machine.
Yes, yeah, in the time machine.
I mean, I live with three women, two younger women and one
nice
older woman. And my... The 15-year-old woman I live with, young woman I live with, is just all about trail running and runs six times a week and does, you know, and it's so nice. I'm going to force her to listen to this when it comes out because, you know, she's lean and jacked and it's up for it and as obsessive as her old man, unfortunately, but it's sort of chasing around the table with food, you know, like you have to eat more, you please, you know, that sense of, you know, but because we're her parents, she's like, shut up, you guys are old and why, you know, like,
you don't know anything, Dad.
You don't know anything. What do you know? Yeah, can't judge me.
Yeah,
fully, like, it's amazing. A karma, tell you what.
Yeah.
But just to hear that, just, you know, very simple expert opinion, just eat and it'll be rad is so helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Because you're welcome. But I mean, there's so many people don't understand that exercising is a fasted state and you want to get out of that fasted state or you're just going to break your body down.
Yeah.
And food does that. Food is amazing. It makes you feel better. It makes you go faster. It makes you fitter. And it's not about calories in, calories out. If anything, put more in. So many people undereat or they eat at the wrong times. And the food is so important.
And it seems like I don't know about, maybe it's our generation, our sort of, it feels like for me, it was that golden epoch of poor ideas in the 90s, and we've just kind of taken that. And I was reading a book by Ranulph Fiennes, and it sort of brought home, he was talking about Shackleton, and he made the thing, and it, you know, if you're sleeping in cold, the Arctic is obviously, or the Antarctic, it's
yeah,
an extreme, but you're burning 4,000 calories just sleeping. You know,
just
so
exist in those conditions.
Just exist, just respiring, yeah.
Yeah,
but especially in your sleep, you can burn 4,000 calories in that sort of cold weather. And when you understand that and actually have it broken, that's so counter the, and I guess we come full circle, but it's counter almost that sort of ingrained narrative, isn't it? Just food's bad, and I don't know what's good, but.
Yeah. No, I blame the 80s. I blame the 80s with their aerobics and their Snackwell fat-free cookies and, you know, all that stuff where...
Richard Simmons, where is he?
Oh, yeah.
There is a great podcast.
That is a great podcast. Finding Richard Simmons. Have you heard that podcast just as a random aside? Finding Richard Simmons.
Incredible. But anyway, we need to track him down and ask him some hard questions.
Yes, we do. I blame him for the messed up mentality that so many of us have around food and exercise. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Wow.
Look, Stacey, you've been so generous with us. This has been a privilege. I'd like to ask you a question that we ask everyone who comes on Dirt Church Radio, and that's Dr. Stacey Sims. What's been your greatest run ever?
My greatest run ever?
Yeah.
Does it have to be a straight run, or can it be something else?
Nope, doesn't have to be.
And it doesn't have to. Yeah, it doesn't have to be anything. Doesn't have to be a race. Doesn't have to be, you know, it can be great for whatever reason you want it to be.
To use the spiel, something that's sung to you for some reason.
Yeah. So my first time at World Championships in Maui for Xterra, I did not enjoy that course. But the second year I went back and I was like, okay, I got this. This is great. I'm here. It's beautiful. But I had found out that I was 8 weeks pregnant before I went. And so I was being very careful. But on the run, I don't know, I just felt light and lifted. And I felt like I was taking my kid with me on a world championship adventure. And it's something that I talk to her and tell her about all the time, that you've raced world championships with mommy. And like it started raining, and then there were rainbows and there were butterflies, and it was just something that was just could have been pregnancy hormones, but it was just something that was super cool and special. So, yeah. And that was the last real race I did.
Where can people find?
Yeah,
apart from all major bookstores, where can people find where can people find your books? Where can people get a hold of you?
So our website, drstacysims.com, has a link to all the books and all the stuff that we're doing, all of our courses, everything. I don't even know what all I'm doing, but it's there.
You do have a lot of hats.
I do.
I mean, this has been again, we feel really privileged. We understand how busy you are, and you've made time for us. So, you know, thank you so very much. Thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for the manner in which it's disseminated. It's just wonderful.
Oh, thanks. And thank you for being in the same time zone and wanting to talk to me, because it's so fun to talk to people that live in the same country and understand everything that's happening. It's such a relief and so fun. So thank you.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, I think in the rundown I wrote that she was aiming to revolutionise nutrition and the approach to sport for women. I actually made a mistake there. She is
revolutionising. Yeah, absolutely she
is. She's not aiming to. She is doing it. Yeah, Stacey, you're an inspiration. And again, we enjoyed listening to that conversation once more.
100%. Yeah, I think back to it, and I think back to how good that was, and getting the sense of, you know, it's exciting, isn't it? It's just exciting. It's so cool. But look, thank you, Stacey, and thank you very much for tuning in. We're on social media at Dirt Church Radio. Email us at dirtchurchradio@gmail.com. You can find us on all the podcast platforms. Like and follow if you fancy, and you can download direct from the website, which is dirtchurchradio.com.
Don't forget to send in your greatest run ever. We'd love to hear from you. People love hearing them, and people love reading them on the website. Send them into us, dirtchurchradio@gmail.com.
Thanks to our sponsors, Scott Running, Further Faster, and Cielli. Thank you to our Patreon patrons and Wild Things. and thanks to our editor, Kieran. Now, stay tuned next week when we return to our regular scheduled programming with an amazing guest, someone we've been wanting to get on for a long time, and it was well worth the wait.
Sure was. Hey, Cornado. Thanks, Rigby.